From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, could the new federal tax plan make your state income taxes go up? We'll get one economist's take.
Unfortunately, a lot of stuff when you look at taxes is subject to interpretation.
Remembering the glory days when Michigan Central Station was the transportation heart of Southeast Michigan.
200 trains a day leaving Michigan Central around World War I. I mean, you're talking about thousands of passengers coming in and out of the station every day.
She survived being trafficked for sex through her childhood.
At that time, I didn't comprehend why other kids were always happy. I didn't understand how they could go through what I was going through at home and be so happy. I didn't know it wasn't happening in their homes.
But today, this tough survivor helps young people who've been trafficked. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up, she survived being trafficked for sex as a child. Now her mission is making a safe place for rescued kids.
If somebody would have recognized maybe something in my life, something could have changed. And I want to be able to go out there and educate them and let them know that you have the power to be able to change that child's life.
But first, the new federal tax bill could mean lower federal taxes. But Governor Snyder and some economists think it could mean higher state income taxes. And that's stirring up fresh talk in Lansing about cutting Michigan's personal income tax to cushion the effects of the federal tax reform. Jeff Guilfoyle is with us now. He's a vice president with Public Sector Consultants. He got his Ph.D. in economics from Michigan State University, and he's the former director of the Office of Revenue and Tax Analysis in the Michigan Department of Treasury. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
So Governor Snyder told the Associated Press that the federal tax overhaul means Michiganders will end up having to pay more to the state. Before we get into whether that's a correct assessment, how did that conclusion arise?
On your state tax return, you get to subtract exemptions before you calculate your tax. So for every person living in your household, basically, you get to subtract $4,000 from your income before you calculate your tax. But the way the state law reads is you get to claim the same number of exemptions as you claim on your federal return. Well, the federal law change basically made that subtraction go away, and so the question is whether that carries through to the state. And if it does, it's a big tax increase in Michigan.
Yes, let's talk about that. So if an individual could lose a $4,000 deduction from taxable income, what could that mean then in an actual hike in state taxes?
So it's $4,000 a person, and at the current tax rate of 4.25%, that's about $170. So for every person living in your household that qualifies as an exemption, your taxes would go up by $170 a year.
So for a family of four, we could be looking at $680 higher.
Yeah, so talking about real money here.
Yeah, real money. So is this something, Jeff, that we're certain will happen?
A couple people have raised questions about whether or not the federal change actually will impact Michigan, and Treasury has said that they're still looking at the issue, which suggests that it's not completely cut and dried. I think part of the issue is that they left some of the language for the personal exemption in at the federal level, but basically made the exemption go to zero. So whether or not that translates into Michigan is kind of an open question that people are still looking at.
Why is this the case? Why is this not clear?
Unfortunately, a lot of stuff when you look at taxes is subject to interpretation. So I think what you end up having is attorneys reading the Internal Revenue Code and trying to decide how that compares to what we have in Michigan tax law and what it really means. I mean, this stuff is just never straightforward.
Did some of this maybe slip through because of just the hasty way it was drawn up?
No, I really don't think it has anything to do with how the feds did what they do. The issue just is that in Michigan, our income tax sort of piggybacks off of the federal tax in a lot of ways. So we use a lot of the federal definitions. Our income that we start with when we're calculating taxes starts with federal adjusted gross income from your federal return. And so what ends up happening is anytime they make changes at the federal level to the federal law, those changes can end up trickling through to Michigan taxes. And so you sort of have to wait until the feds are done and then look and see what the implications of any changes they made were on Michigan's taxes.
If we lose that $4,000 exemption, the state exemption for every federal personal exemption, it could mean a $1.4 billion tax windfall for Lansing. And now we have the governor saying we ought to give that back to taxpayers, and that's sparking new debate over cutting the state personal income tax. We saw House Speaker Tom Leonard push hard last year to roll them back, even as the governor opposed it, and it failed. Why did it fail?
Michigan's budget is really tight at the moment, and there are a lot of provisions that are coming online in the next couple years that are going to keep the budget tight, particularly the diversion of some of the income tax money to help pay for roads, some of the payments related to the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, so there's not a lot of extra room in the budget. That said, the big difference between saying that you're going to cut Michigan taxes and then saying that you're going to allow Michigan taxes to go up by $1.4 billion, $1.4 billion is a big tax increase. I mean, that's $140 per capita. And so I think it's probably safe to assume that it's very unlikely that if Treasury concludes that this is going to be a tax increase, that the legislature won't go in and try to undo it.
So we'll see this effect energize the tax cutters in the state legislature.
Yes. And I think you could even argue that it's not necessarily cutting taxes. You're just sort of putting things back to the status quo and sort of correcting an unanticipated consequence of the federal change.
What is the argument, if any, against softening state taxes to offset the effects of the federal tax plan?
Well, I mean, not a good one. I mean, the argument basically would be is if you were interested in trying to get additional revenues for the state budget and didn't think you had the votes to get it through the legislature, then this is sort of a way to backdoor into more money. So it's an additional $1.4 billion, and it's not easy to come up with that type of money. As you noted, this is a big tax increase for a lot of Michigan families if it were to go through, an unanticipated tax increase and one that the legislature didn't plan on. And so I think it's unlikely that this will live. I think the question is whether Treasury decides that no legislative action is needed or whether the legislature is actually going to have to change state law to keep this tax increase from going into place.
And next week is the annual revenue estimating meeting, and Governor Snyder says that's when he'll propose his recommendations for what to do about all of this. What are some of his options that you see?
You know, the Revenue Estimating Conference has got to assume current state law so that if Treasury decides that this is going to increase revenues by $1.4 billion, then I think that you'll see that in the revenue estimates, and then you'll see legislators and Treasury quickly saying right after that not to count on that money because they're planning on making that money go away by fixing this problem. If you want to fix this problem, the way that you're really going to need to do it is you're going to basically need to just recreate the exemption as it was in state law. So basically, whatever language was creating at the federal level, you're going to have to put it in state law. If you do anything other than recreate the exemption, then you start to have distribution problems. So if you try to lower the income tax in some other way by $1.4 billion, then what you'll see is some taxpayers seeing their taxes go up and some taxpayers seeing their taxes go down. If you want to make it so that everybody is held harmless, there's only sort of one way to go, and that's to put the personal exemption back at $4,000 and change state law to make sure that happens.
So crack open that state law and rewrite it.
Yeah, so now the good thing is, since this was already in federal law, you've got a pretty good model to just look at how it used to be written in federal law and just copy it into state law. So it should be relatively straightforward for state policymakers to make this change.
Jeff Guilfoyle, Vice President with Public Sector Consultants. Jeff, thank you so much for spending time with us.
You're quite welcome.
There is a hepatitis A outbreak in southeast Michigan. The virus has infected more than 600 people so far. But there's a limited supply of vaccine. And that means health officials have to choose who gets it and who has to wait. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith reports one of the groups high on the get list is restaurant workers.
All the snow and cold and even a bummed wrist from a recent fall didn't stop Otis Lee from his mission.
Let's get you down.
Using a cane, Lee hobbled into the student center at the University of Detroit Mercy. Lee heard about the hepatitis A outbreak on the news.
It doesn't worry me. It concerns me because anything that happens in the city that gave me all that I have concerns me. And I just want to make people aware that they need to be concerned, too, and get this shot.
That's why Lee is here. His corned beef sandwiches are a legend to many Detroiters. Lee ran Mr. Fofo's Deli for about 3 decades. In its heyday, people lined up to get a taste of toasted rye bread, piled high with meat, topped with mustard. Lee just reopened Mr. Fofo's after the deli was closed for a few years. No one at Mr. Fofo's has come down with hepatitis A, and he wants to keep it that way. That's why he's insisting all his employees get the shot.
Yeah, I want to assure my customers that they're dealing with healthy people.
food handlers at 7 Detroit restaurants have been diagnosed with hepatitis A since October. We know that because the Detroit Health Department has put out a public notice about every one of them. Jonae Khaldun heads the Detroit Health Department.
If there is a potential that someone could have exposed mass amounts of people and that we don't have good contact information for those people, that's where you'll start to see these kind of public announcements about specific restaurants.
But it's not just Detroit. Pizza joints in Southfield, Southgate, and Grosse Pointe Woods have been affected. A coffee shop in Monroe, a bar in Westland, an Indian restaurant in Ann Arbor. And those are just the ones we know about. Five food workers at five different restaurants in Macomb County have contracted hepatitis A, but the health department there decided not to publicize any of those cases. State law doesn't require a public notice. Ingham County's had one that they didn't publicize either. Linda Vail is the health officer there.
There is no solid rule that says if a food service handler is sick, you must notify the public. And rightly so. We'd be notifying the public like crazy all the time.
Vail says they carefully consider the risk of transmission from that infected worker to the public. They don't want to freak people out if there's no reason to.
Anytime we release something like that to the press, people then start to get the idea that things are like, oh my gosh, you know, you can ruin the business of restaurants by notifying every time you turn around when the situation is really not that dire.
John Ward is director of the Division of Viral Hepatitis for the CDC. He backs up Vail's assessment.
Eating food at a restaurant in Southeast Michigan is very, very low risk for hepatitis A.
Still, restaurant workers are a priority for the limited supply of the hepatitis A vaccine simply because of the nature of their work. Poor hand washing and then handling food is an easy way for hepatitis A to get around. Oakland County's health officer, Leanne Stafford, says there are a lot of misconceptions about Hep A.
Most people say, oh, I have a vaccine against that, or, oh, that doesn't involve me because, oh, that's just somebody that does IV drug, use. But we are seeing people that do not do heavy drugs. They're not homeless.
37% of people involved in Michigan's outbreak say they do not use drugs and they are not homeless.
There's anything we can stress, get vaccinated or at least have a conversation with your physician to determine if you should be vaccinated or if you haven't been vaccinated.
The only reason health officials aren't telling everyone to get vaccinated is because there's a limited supply. But every health officer and doctor I've talked to said they won't turn anyone away. I'm Lindsay Smith, Michigan Radio News.
You can find a link to vaccination clinics all over Southeast Michigan by going to our website, michiganradio.org. Still to come, it has been 30 years since a train left Michigan Central. What's next for the iconic station?
I mean, if Detroit can turn around this symbol of its decay and turn into a symbol of its rebirth, I mean, that would just be such a story for Detroit.
That comes up in 10 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In this era of texting and tweeting, we risk losing some of the marvelous words that add texture and meaning to conversation and writing. So come on, Michigan, let's up our collective language game. A good place to begin is checking out the newest list from the Wayne State University Word Warriors. They dig around in the linguistic cellar and recover neglected words that deserve a place in 2018. Jerry Heron is with us now. He's the dean of the Irving D. Reed Honors College at Wayne State, and he is on the editorial board of the Word Warriors website. Jerry, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you. I wish you a wonderful new year and many wonderful words in this 2018.
Well, the first thing I checked, saw when I checked out your website was the phrase, bringing back great words. What to you is a great word, Jerry?
I'll tell you one that I'm really fond of, nugatory, N-U-G-A-T-O-R-Y. Meaning of no value or importance. So we might say he rambled on for hours, his big words making the nugatory contribution he made to the debate. Now, nugatory, one reason we like that is that it sounds great. It's just fun to say. You could say, well, that's of no value, that's of no importance, but to say nugatory is just a lot more fun.
So it adds depth and meaning to our conversations when we find these great words?
Exactly. I think the world is only as interesting, as delightful, as colorful as our ability to experience the world. And bringing back great words that will make the world more vivid, present, and also accurate. For example, eucatastrophe. Now, that's one that J.R.R. Tolkien invented. And it's a sudden or favorable resolution of events in a story, a happy ending, especially one that involves getting a hero off the hook unexpectedly. So if you spent any time over the holidays in a superhero movie, you probably encountered a eucatastrophe, and now you've got a word to describe it.
That is great. I have to admit, Jerry, I saw your list, and I was very happy to see a word that was used in such an expressive way by none other than General George Patton. Let's pause a moment now and listen to a clip from 1970s Oscar winner for Best Picture. Here's George C. Scott delivering that memorable speech to the Third Army.
An army is a team. It lives, eats, sleeps, fights as a team. This individuality stuff is a bunch of crap. The bilious bastards who wrote that stuff about individuality for the Saturday Evening Post don't know anything more about real battle than they do about fornicating.
That word bilious was on your list.
It is indeed, and that shows the richness of our English language. English has perhaps got more words in our lexicon than any other language, and it's really special kind of language because it's picked up things along the way. It starts as Germanic, and then it picks up some French and the Norman invasion after it gets to the British Isles, and then we get some Latin and some Greek, and bilious goes back to this idea that our temperament is governed by the four humors, one of them, of course, being bile. And that tends to make a person spiteful or bad-tempered, just as General Patton used that word there.
Well, one might argue General Patton had a pretty bilious temperament himself.
Exactly, but he did prove himself to be insuperable, that is, impossible to overcome as a commander. And that's another one. You could say, oh, well, he was a commander impossible to overcome often in battles, but it's a lot more fun to say, I think, insuperable.
Indeed. Now, how do words slip away from us and become, actually, to use one of your words, recondite?
Nice word, that, recondite. That is a subject of knowledge that is little known or abstruse. He couldn't pass a history quiz to save his life, but the voracious reader was a repository of facts and recondite information. Well, I think what happens is that we have the richness of the English language with perhaps a quarter of a million unique words. We've got so many of them, we oftentimes forget to use a word or a particular set of words, or we forget that we've got this range of experiences we could describe with one of these great words. So it's worth thumbing through that lexicon occasionally to see if there are good words that we need to bring back.
Now, how do you and the Word Warriors dig up these words and then decide to feature them on your website or your annual list?
This is where we could use the help of anybody who's listening to this program. If you go to wordwarriors.wayne.edu, we would love to have you suggest a word. Bring us some new words. That's exactly where our list comes from. We're always compiling lists of good words from folks that come to the website, nominate a word, tell us why they think it ought to come back into currency.
Now, how do we use these words without sounding like a smarty pants show off?
In other words, you don't want to sound recondite. That's what we're saying.
Okay.
Well, we want you to be very couth. That's a good one, too. We usually hear this word couth as uncouth. Well, it's just as good if you drop the un. Couth meaning cultured, or refined, or well-mannered. I think the cultured, refined, or well-mannered, the couth person, would introduce a new word just the same way that you would introduce a friend to some new experience, a new food that the friend has never eaten. You wouldn't shame the friend because the friend had never used that word or tasted that delicacy that you want to share. You would invite the friend instead into a new source of pleasure and play and fun. And I think that's the point, not to be recondite, but to be couth about this whole thing.
And all things in moderation.
Absolutely the case. Good New Year's resolution.
You can submit words that deserve to be trotted back out and used more widely by going to the Word Warriors website. As Jerry said, it was wordwarriors.wayne.edu. Jerry Herron, Dean of the Irving D. Reed Honors College at Wayne State and on the editorial board of the Word Warriors website. And we want to thank you for everything you're doing to bring back great words, Jerry.
And thank you indeed. And as I said, wishing you a great new year and many more great words in 2018. Bring them to us.
It's Wednesday, time to talk Michigan's history.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
30 years ago this week, January 5th, 1988, the last train left Michigan Central Station. And that moment marked the end of nearly 75 years of people catching trains at the once proud station. Dan Austin is with us. He's written three books about Detroit history, and he is the founder of HistoricDetroit.org. And we also welcome Mark Harvey, the state archivist, here with us from the Michigan History Center. Happy New Year to both of you.
Happy New Year.
Same to you.
I remember Michigan Central. Actually, I had a great uncle who spent his career working in that building. I remember that final train 30 years ago. But boy, there are a lot of people who never knew it as anything but that big, hulking, empty, sad building between Corktown and Mexicantown. Dan, describe Michigan Central in its heyday and what it meant to Southeast Michigan.
Well, when the building opened, it opened as the tallest rail station in the world. So if you could imagine Detroit with the advent of the automobile, or the automobile really coming into its prime, Detroit was poised for greatness, and few things made a first impression on people as the first building they saw when they stepped off the train. So Michigan Central was a grand building showing a city on the rise. It was decked to the nines. It was designed by the same two firms that did Grand Central Station in New York. So it's kind of got like this Beaux-Arts outside. The waiting room is done up like the old baths of ancient Rome with a 65-foot ceiling. I mean, this building made an impression on people, not just of the station, but of the city itself.
So it's basically throwing down that card on the table saying, we're terrific.
Yeah, Detroit is such an amazing city. Check out our Temple of Transportation, as you will. You know, it was really an incredible way to kind of roll out the welcome mat, not just to people traveling, visitors, to people arriving in Detroit to work in the auto factories. I mean, it was really a grand statement of what the Motor City had become and would continue to grow into.
Mark Harvey, the station's about a mile or so west of the heart of downtown Detroit. Do we know why that location of Michigan Avenue and 14th Street was chosen?
We have some clues to it. The original station was located at 3rd and Jefferson, and Michigan Central Railroad was a growing business around the turn of the century, growing rapidly. In 1906, they started construction on a tunnel to connect with Canada. And as Dan said, Detroit was booming. And so the thought was, as the city expands, the idea was planted to locate that new station, that Temple of Transportation, as I think Dan accurately pointed out, about 3/4 of a mile west, to encourage that outward growth.
So, Dan, when did construction start, and how long did it take to build this grand temple?
So a building of this size took a few years. You know, it's not something you whip out overnight. So the construction began in 1910, and it wasn't until 1912 that we had the steel framework for this building up. And then, as Mark noted, the old station, which was downtown, burned on December 26, 1913. So they had to rush the new station into service early. It was supposed to open up the following month. The newspaper articles at the time said, you know, as they were extinguishing the last of the flames at the old depot, the first of the new trains were coming into the station, which is really pretty incredible when you think about it.
It is.
You know, it's that the Detroit can do, nothing stops Detroit kind of mentality.
So after that rough start, how did things go for the Michigan Central Station in its first few decades?
At first, things were great. I mean, again, the station opened in 1913. 1914, that World War I era, was the peak of rail travel in the United States. Yes, cars were there, but there weren't freeways. You know, the only other way to get around the Midwest was on these majestic Great Lakes steamers. So trains were really your only way to go. So, I mean, you had 200 trains a day leaving Michigan Central around World War I. I mean, you're talking about thousands of passengers coming in and out of the station every day. And it stayed good up until, you know, the 1950s. You had the freeway system come in that really cost the station a lot of its travelers. And then by 1971, you know, the federal government stepped in and created Amtrak because the for-profit rail companies were no longer profitable, or they had gone out of business. And then you had the oil crisis in the early 70s, which kept that going for a little while, but it was only a matter of time before the American rail system kind of declined.
So the years marched on, and even, am I right, Mark, that Amtrak took control of the station in 71 and did some renovations?
Yeah, they tried to pump some new life into the station, and Amtrak in the 70s reopened the ornate waiting room, but there was no connection to the airport. It was still sitting west of downtown, and with the rise of automobiles, even with the energy crisis, it was disconnected, and I think it was just an inevitability that it was going to slowly peter out.
Kind of withering on the vine. Dan Austin, did anything special mark that last train, January 5th, 1988?
Not really. You know, the newspapers at the time covered it, television stations, whatever, but it was an old relic of an older era, you know, bygone era, and it had been declined for so long. By 88, that was in the past, and it was just kind of on the outskirts, this giant hulking building. You know, Beaux-Arts behemoth that had already been kind of grimy and run down. So people just kind of said, you know, see you later. And keep in mind, Detroit was also still in the decline. I mean, the 80s were not a great time for Detroit. It was losing population, the Devil's Night fires, crime. So it was just one of those things where, like so much of the city, we just turned our backs on it and walked away.
Except for the scavengers and the scrappers, because certainly now they've had decades to hurt the building.
Yeah, it was not long after the station closed that the scrappers got to work and just ripped it apart. You saw sconces being stolen, chandeliers, marble. Vandals got in and spray-painted graffiti everywhere. It really was an undignified way to end what had been this grandiose building and such a symbol of pride. It quickly became a symbol of Detroit's decay. You know, I mean, I don't think that there's been a building other than maybe the Packard plant, but even that's questionable, that has been used to illustrate Detroit's decline as much as Michigan Central. I mean, even when you're looking at these movies like Transformers and Batman versus Superman, you know, when they want to show this war-torn, destroyed kind of building, they always go to Michigan Central Station.
When you talk about ruin porn, which is a phrase many people despise, but that kind of epitomizes it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think it's also important to note here, you know, I know that the Maroon family, which owns it, and the Ambassador Bridge, takes a lot of heat for the station's condition, but they bought it in 1995, and the scrappers and vandals had already had their go at it by the time. Now, clearly, he didn't do a whole lot to stabilize it and prevent further decay until more recent years, working with Mayor Duggan. But, I mean, this building had been, you know, open to trespass and vandals for 7 years by the time the Maroons got their hands on it.
And here we are in 2017, where we see a younger generation who aren't particularly interested in cars, who would welcome a good train station. And there have been ideas for ways to use Michigan Central through the years. Dan, what have been the sticking points?
Money. I mean, it all comes down to money. You know, you're looking at a building that is so big. I mean, it's 18 stories tall. The waiting room would take probably $100 million on its own. I mean, you got stone missing, marble missing. I mean, I'm not an architect or a construction engineer, but you know, probably $250 to $300 million. And it's just really hard to make that money work. And I think that there are some things that are going in the building's favor these days, unlike the previous 30 years, such as you have a lot of investment and restoration of historic buildings in downtown Detroit. We're seeing buildings that we never thought would be open, buildings that had closed before I was born, now being restored. That certainly helps. When you look at 2009, when the Detroit City Council passed a resolution to use economic stimulus money to tear it down, which fortunately they were unable to do because of its placement on the National Register of Historic Places, things have changed a lot. I mean, in the past 9 years, things have finally swung in his favor, but unfortunately, that price tag is still going to be a big hill to overcome.
We were all having kind of a discussion on New Year's Day about the question, right now, as we talk in 2018, is the building structurally sound? Could it be put to good use, or has it been too long and now it's too damaged?
I think that it's still salvageable. Any building, if you're willing to throw money at it, is salvageable. Granted, I'm a preservationist, I'm a building hugger, but I can't think of anyone who wouldn't want to see this building saved. I mean, if Detroit can turn around this symbol of its decay and turn it into a symbol of its rebirth, I mean, that would just be such a story for Detroit. I mean, we have, you know, finally overcome and we have reclaimed our rightful placement as one of America's greatest cities.
Let me ask you, Mark Harvey, as a Michigan History Center perspective, in your gut, do you believe we will see a new chapter and a new life for Michigan Central?
I hope so. I think an interesting postscript to this is about 4 years ago, the Archives of Michigan was contacted by an individual who, leading up to those last days of the station being opened in 1988, was in contact with employees of the railroad that had been ordered just to clear materials out. And as often happens with company records, employees are not wanting to throw them away. They just took the materials out and saved them. They got passed from one place to the other and became overwhelming. And we were contacted, unfortunately, maybe a little too late because a lot of them were in bad condition. But we were able to salvage a large portion of the as-built architectural drawings of the station. If you know anything about architecture, it's a little bit different to get the as-builts than presentation copies. I know that there's copies of the original elevations at the Burton Historical Collection at the Detroit Public Library, but these are the drawings that would be in the building and used by facilities staff and are just an incredible trove of information about the inner workings of that structure. So do I think it's going to happen? I hope so. Can it? I think we have the records to enable that.
Well, I'll tell you what, as just someone who, as I said, remembers it as it was a wonderfully vibrant building when I was a kid, and then remembering that final train, hard to believe it's been 30 years. And certainly, I think all of us can agree in our lifetimes, we would sure like to see that building come back to life again. Dan Austin with HistoricDetroit.org, Mark Harvey, Michigan History Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We'll be right back after a very short break, so stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The image of a mama bear is clear. She will do anything, fight anyone, to protect her cubs. And that's why Mindy Ozentowski of West Michigan calls herself Mama Bear. Her mission is protecting young victims of sex trafficking, rescuing them, and then staying right with them through recovery and healing. And Mama Bear knows what these young people have endured. That's because as a child, she was trafficked by her stepfather. Mindy is with us now. And a word of warning, our conversation may not be suitable for young listeners. Mama Bear, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great, and it's good to have you here. And you really have transformed yourself from Mindy to Mama Bear. Tell us more why you chose that Mama Bear name.
Actually, that name was chosen for me. I had gotten saved in 2001. It was a process of like 5-6 years of going through healing. And in 2006, my Christian husband that I was married to was killed in a car accident. And my son was critically injured during that time. At the time, the trafficker that I was pawned off to when I was 15 was the father to my son that was injured in the car accident. Well, they had transferred my son from Muskegon to Ann Arbor Hospital. And my son was there probably 6 months. During that time when he got released, he couldn't travel more than an hour. He actually couldn't walk. He was missing the parts of his brain to walk and talk at the time. During that time, my son was convinced that I wasn't wanting to be in his life for a few years. And it was like a couple years after that, I always like hung out up in the Hesperia area at the dam with like my daughter and her friends and those younger kids that would hang out. And all of a sudden, these young kids would be talking to me, asking me what I'm doing. I'd be up there drawing or reading the Bible, and they start talking to me about their problems. And next thing you know, they'd bring another one and another one. And I was kind of annoyed. I didn't want to deal with none of these young boys. I was like, I have my own son, and I'm not even able to see him, you know. And I was frustrated with that. And they just kept coming around. And the more they come around, they kept, you know, calling me like Mama Bear. And I started doing stuff with them. It's like, well, we could do something Saturday. You know, maybe you guys could just go to the beach or whatever. And we'd have days where we'd just go do whatever on Saturday and Sunday. I would end up taking them to church, and I'd never tell them where we were going. It's like, no, we're just going to the beach. And then we'd go to church and then go to the beach, you know?
The idea that you have been through this thing, this ordeal, that you're trying to now help other youngsters out of is stunning. And knowing that your stepfather trafficked you, starting at what age?
My earliest childhood memory. It went on there for a long time till I was like 13 years old.
Did he take you to people's houses? I mean, what happened?
No, people had come to our houses. There was hunting camps and different things that had happened. There was multiple men in our childhood that had happened through.
What about your mother?
My mother was a very codependent woman, and she was very aware of what was going on. But she didn't
protect you?
No, she didn't stand up or anything like that.
How did you get out of that house then? How long did that last? You were what?
I was there till I was 13, and there was a girl in school who had rode the bus with me, had lunch with me, and one day she had come in the bathroom, because I used to go in there instead of the lunchroom. At that time, I didn't comprehend why other kids were always happy. I didn't understand how they could go through what I was going through at home and be so happy. I didn't know it wasn't happening in their homes. She come in there to share lunch with me one day, and I got scared and freaked out on her, like, what do you want? What do you want from me? You know, why are you even talking to me? And it was not too long after that, a cop and a teacher had talked with me. But I had no idea for years that girl is the one that said that. I always thought it was the teacher that noticed something. Later on in life, this girl had got a hold of me on Facebook. She said, I remember you. And she said, she started asking me about seeing me in the bathroom with bruises and bleeding and washing up and different things. She was so scared because she told the teacher. And I said, you told the teacher?
So
she was
she
like, yes,
saw.
I did. Yeah. Mm. She was really scared. She wanted her mom to come get me. Like, you need to go get her. Something's wrong. And when she told the teacher and that, I never knew about it for all those years. And it, to me, that blew my mind when I did find out. But she literally thought something happened to me, that I died. And really what had happened is the teacher and a cop had been talking to me about what went on.
And you were able to finally...
I was just talking, like normal.
Did you think this happened everywhere?
Yeah, I thought it happened to everyone. Like, there was no normalcy to it. You know, like, inside I knew something was very wrong with what was happening. I didn't like it. I didn't want it. When the cop was talking to me, he was asking me questions, and as I answered him, he was crying, and I didn't understand why he was crying. And I asked him, why are you crying? And he said, moms and dads are not supposed to do this to their children. And I got an instant anger inside of me that rose up, and I was like, I knew that happened.
That affirmed the fact that,
yeah, that affirmed what I knew. And
what did he do?
Actually, we went home that day. And
you went home with the officer?
On the bus, like a normal school day.
They didn't take you out? Or
no, they didn't do anything at that moment. When I got home, my ex-stepdad, he had come home, and he always would call one of us to come do his shoes or whatever, take them off. That day he had did that to me, and I was taking his shoes off. He started doing what he normally do. He would just start fondling me and stuff. And I pushed him away, and I ran downstairs, and I told my mom that you guys aren't supposed to be doing this to us. The cop told me. And when I told her that, she looked like she'd seen a ghost.
Because you said cop.
Yeah, the cop told me and the teacher that you are not supposed to be doing this. And she went upstairs, and I'll never forget hearing the screams of, you know, it was really scary at that moment.
But I'm still stunned that you weren't removed on the spot.
No.
Do you think today you would have been? Do we know more today? When you think of a youngster saying, this has been happening to me for years. The idea that had you go back to class and you got on the bus and went home is kind of mind-blowing.
It's sad, but a lot of them need more evidence to be able to remove a child from a home.
How long did it take you to get out of that house?
Actually, it was within the next few days. That day, my mom and her husband at the time had took us to his parents' house, dropped us off. Then 2-3 days went by, and they come back to get us, and that next day my mom had said, I want you to wear extra clothes to school when we were going to school because we were leaving. Well, we got all our stuff together. I wore extra clothes, and then she took us and we left and we went to Detroit to live. And it was during that time, within the first couple of days of being there, I had a nice uncle that had taught me what good sex was. So at the point, I mean, we were going to court. My ex-stepdad was charged with child molestation.
But you didn't get out of it because you had this uncle.
No, it went on further, and it just kind of went deeper into stuff. It didn't stop for a long time. Actually, what had happened to me is we moved back up to the area where I was trafficked at as a kid, and I became rebellious. It was only my mom then, so I was, like, really hardcore. I was going to school, but I was skipping school a lot. And me and my friend were skipping school one day, and this is when I ran into a kid he was busting up a caboose at the park, and he was yelling and screaming about his dad abusing his mom, beating his mom. And I mean, I could just relate to this kid, but I mean, he was just like mad. Next thing you know, the cops pulled up, and he took off running. Him and his friend took off running, and I was sitting in the caboose, and all I could think about is his dad is still there, and he could get beat. So I told the cops when they asked who did it, I said, I did. And I was just a little tiny thing, and they were like, there's no way. You know, I said, no, I did do this. I did it all by myself, you know. And they took me to the jail, and this kid that everyone said to stay away from, that was a horrible kid, come into the police station and said, you know, she did not do it. I did it. And took the blame, stood up for me. It was the one person I seen my entire life that stood up for me, and it was a kid that everyone said to stay away from. And that's what birthed Mama Bear and Cub Ministries in my life.
That is amazing. Yeah. And you've been working to rescue, recover young people from sex trafficking, and then what?
Actually, I have been working with establishing relationships and consistency with young men. That was a big thing because a lot of young men don't have help that they need. They don't even get knowledge. Out of the 131 some cubs that I've had, there's like only 20 that weren't sexually or physically abused in their childhood. And these are small-time boys. Mm-hmm.
So these are boys in trouble. You are there trying to help. Do you also work with girls?
Yeah, I do work with some of them. When I did the Cub Ministry, I had a few tough, hardcore girls that would join the group. And it was neat because they made it very clear. I was calling them Cubettes, and they're like, no, we're Cubs too. From there, I have a friend, Erin McMahon, Kilgo. She does a fire group, Fire Above Rubies group for girls. And on the being on the front lines of human sex trafficking for a long time, you bring awareness, but there's not really an answer to how can you help them? How can you get to the root of being consistent so that they can communicate? Because you got trauma patients right there. And they can't communicate like normal because 9 times out of 10, they've been told that if they tell, they're going to jail. There's so much fear, you know.
And you understand that.
Yeah,
I mean,
understand
they're programmed.
It.
It's like you've been brainwashed.
Yeah.
You've been abused.
Yeah.
And you don't know that there's any other way.
No, and being able to come alongside these young kids, I can't talk specifically about details, but I do know that it was a lifesaver for this girl to have a survivor advocate standing next to her. Had it not been standing next to her, they would have just marked her up as a runaway drug head kid that was just a troublemaker. And that, to me, blew my mind that people perceived that. And then it makes me look at, see, how many runaways are there out there marked as that? That were probably victims of some form of trafficking, some form of abuse, and they've been neglected because they've been passed off as the troubled kids, just like most of my cubs. Kids
just like you were. And,
yeah.
And that boy that stepped up for you, who everybody said was the bad kid, was the one who was the first to step up for you. So you know you need to look deeper.
Exactly. When I first started doing the Cub Ministry, I had CPS come, you know, like, this is like a flop house, what's going on here? And I had other adults that helped me with these kids to hang out, and it was crazy because they brought me a case of like probably about 10 kids that had really bad histories of trouble. And they were telling me how bad of an influence these kids are. And I looked at them, and every single one of these kids had told me about abuse they had gone through when they were a child.
So you are the frontline advocate.
Yeah.
So you go to court. You're there with hospitals. Do you intervene with teachers?
With teachers, I sat at school. I've sat in classes, you know, and went back to school with them, you know, to make them feel comfortable because bullying is bad enough as it is. And bullying is one of the top signs of human trafficking and abuse.
If somebody is a bully?
A bully or being bullied. Both of those are avenues of a sign of serious abuse going on at home. And a lot of people miss that and don't recognize that.
What do young trafficking survivors most need, Mama Bear, that you feel that they're not getting from the system, from the community?
They need to be heard. They need to be recognized. Actually, they need a lot of things, but one of the things, like in the area where I'm at on the west side, there's no drug rehab or home for human trafficking victims or trauma victims in West Michigan over there, except for Manassa Project, which is in Grand Rapids. And Manassa Project can only hold so many. So unless these children are psychologically deemed as suicidal or serious drug addicts, unless they're deemed that, there is no safe place for them to go. There's not. Because there's no qualifications for the state to fund it. So you have to be able to get state funding. And I do notice that in Ingham County, they're adopting a protocol establishing care for trafficking victims without distinguishing the rights of the parents if the parents were not involved in it. But right now, as it is, you know, a lot of the counties take the kids, and it almost as if they're getting punished. They can't be around their parents, and they're just doing it for safety, but they can't be around their parents. They can't be around the people that were supporting them. So they're feeling more like the criminal. And to me, that is not right for
victims. It's not protecting
them. It's not protecting them. Because anybody knows that anybody that's been through trauma, you need a consistency because no kid's going to just open up. You got them transforming from a police officer to a hospital getting checked, for child abuse counselors, and then you got other counselors coming in. They need a consistent support, and that's what I believe Angels of Healing is going to establish with them, is that survivor advocates that have been through it, that have overcome, that are broken once, that know exactly what it takes to stand and heal and be able to recognize the signs of the triggers when they're wanting to block off and not communicate. You can see that in them, and you can help them to open up and communicate.
Because you've been there.
And that's what I see can happen with these young kids. And that's why Angels of Healing started, and it just started recently.
And we should let everybody know, Angels of Healing is this effort that you've launched
yes.
in West Michigan.
Yes. And I want it to be a battle cry for the youth in Michigan. The battle cry that will reach from the east to the west to the north to south of Michigan, that we need to join forces and all our tools and equipment that we have to be able to help these youth and young people. These are our future. They're not just write-offs. They have kids that they label as throwaways. There is no child as a throwaway. These are live kids. These are breathing kids. I've even had, as in the Cub ministry, I've had moms drop off their kids at my home saying that my boyfriend doesn't like him. He can't stay there. And he's 15 years old. It's like, I'm sorry, but you were chosen to be a parent till he's 18. And a lot of people don't realize how many of these kids are. My battle cry is not only to go out and rescue them and help them, but also to see if there's safe homes that we can establish all over Michigan that could say, I could take that kid in my home and get approved, you know, through the system of like foster care and adopt that kid until he's graduated or he or she. Because sex trafficking happens to boys and girls, and people don't realize it. They don't even recognize that boys are just as much victims as girls are.
And you're hoping to take Angels of Healing around the state.
All around the state. And then from the state to another city to show them how it's done, that you can do this. You can go in and you could sit down with these kids and you see the transformation. The one girl that I do know, I see her today and she can smile and she can laugh and she is standing up for herself, advocating for herself. And I'm just like, look at that girl go. I've seen kids in counseling for years that never had the benefit of seeing a survivor stand next to them and that relationship build a surety of trust with them that they're not afraid no more to stand. That's what I want to establish.
Talk to the teachers, the relatives, and the friends and the classmates out there. What are the signs that a child is being trafficked, a child is being abused? What do we watch for?
A lot of times it's the very least likely things. The kid that isn't very social in school, you would think, yeah, that maybe that would be a sign. And that is sometimes a sign, but sometimes the overly popular ones. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that young girls today in age, they want to be with their boyfriends. You know, there's boyfriends that'll take them and take them to parties where there's older guys hanging out. And next thing you know, they're hanging out with these older guys and end up drinking, and some of them get drugged. It's not just that scenario, though. There's child pornography that's very involved. Kids can come to school and they're very closed. Sometimes they're not clean, they're dirty, they're not able to shower and etiquette right. And some of them will act out even more rebellious in school. They'll be more angry at school. And those are definite signs. And probably the kid that you don't want to talk to is the kid that probably has the biggest issue. And I would say out of all my Cubs, the ones that were the hardest, hardcore, mean, ornery-est, I'd had to get mean and ornery right back, which teachers can't do that, okay? But being a survivor advocate or maybe a counselor or having assigning students that maybe have a good rapport with communication with other children, they can be able to establish relationships with those hardcore. I always tell kids that when you see a bully in school, just go up to them, you know, real quick and be like, you know, if you ever need to talk, here I am, and run if you have to. They will lash out and they will do stuff they're not supposed to do. But that's when you got to show them the more concern and love, because there's something going on at home that they don't want to talk about. If you see things, don't be afraid to call. Most people in small towns have this ideal in their head that I don't want to get involved. Well, you could have saved that child's life. If somebody would have recognized maybe something in my life, something could have changed. And I want to be able to go out there and educate them and let them know that you have the power to be able to change that child's life. And I speak a lot about human sex trafficking, of child exploitation, because that's where I come from. But you go out and check out human trafficking, like child pornography sites, there's busts around your area, around where you've lived. Well, there's pictures attached with those. Where do they get the children in these pictures? This is being forced and coerced. That's human sex trafficking. Every one of these children, innocents, are getting stolen on a daily basis, and we need more people to step up and say, hey, this don't look right across the street. I'm going to do something.
Well, you can learn more about Mama Bear's work with Angels of Healing and reach out to her by going to the website, angelsofhealing.org. So your call is to Michigan, come on and help me with this mission.
Yeah, it's definitely a battle cry to Michigan. We need your help. Your voice matters. This is a time to stand up for the ones whose voices are just innocent. They're little. They need you to stand up, and I'm asking you to stand up to bring some form of healing centers in Michigan for youth that have been victims of human sex trafficking.
Mindy Ozentowski, Mama Bear, thanks for being with us and sharing your work.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Stay warm. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.